Well, the MK party is flying. Won another by-election yesterday, smashing the ANC. And it does reflect a changed mood in KwaZulu-Natal, if not the country as a whole. Frans Cronier, a political analyst, economic analyst, and the chairman of the SRF Foundation, will give us his insights on that and lots of other issues, an update after we spoke 2 weeks ago. Well, it's an interesting time that we're going through politically in South Africa. I had a fascinating discussion with Corne Mulder yesterday, the new leader of the Freedom Front, and I'll pick up with that in a moment. But Frans, the breaking news from yesterday's by-election in rural KwaZulu-Natal, Mandeni, where the ANC's safe seat was lost. In fact, they came third behind MK, which got 42% of the vote, and the IFP, which got 30% of the vote. The ANC right down to 27.5% in an area where it should have won comfortably. But I guess that was before Jacob Zuma put his hat in the ring.
Yeah, very capable person, Mr. Zuma. I was in fact saying it at dinner last night for clients that if I had to run a political campaign in SA, I'd take two people with me, Jacob Zuma and Helen Zille. And that would be a pretty unbeatable combination. I don't know the ward, Alex. I don't know the details of the local dynamics there, but what I suppose would also be relevant is just the traditional driver of ANC support, that if the material circumstances of people don't improve, then ANC support falls away. I mean, we've seen that for 30 years. And 200 days into the GNU, there's nothing that's coming out of the ANC camp that would suggest to its supporters that their material circumstances are improving or are set to improve. And as long as that remains the case, the ANC's got to expect that its support is going to fall away further. Now, that's definitely what polls of the last month or two have shown, or since the election, in fact, pre the election as well. We did another one about 2 weeks ago, and it wasn't really what we weren't really looking at the political balance. We were testing something else, and so it's an imperfect test, but nonetheless, we also asked the political question, and we found again that we had the DA ahead of the ANC. So you know, if this was an ANC strategy session, all I'd say is, if you don't create any jobs, if you don't have any growth and any investment, then yeah, expect that your support is going to fall away faster and faster.
It's an interesting point that you make there. I'm what used to be called a banana boy. That's my homeland, the KZN province. So I know Isithebe, I know Mandeni, I know that area. And Isithebe is one of the industrial centers in KZN. So it actually aligns exactly with what you were saying earlier, that the people who live there would have been drawn there for jobs, and the jobs are falling away. So as a result, you have this massive, massive swing. But before we move away from these big changes, it's interesting to notice in Cape Town, now the leader of the EFF has also moved across to the Democratic Alliance. So it wasn't long ago that the leader of the ANC in the Cape Town Council moved to the DA. That you could almost understand, given the way that they are imploding. But the EFF's leadership, you would have thought that that's quite a long way. Well, you wouldn't have thought. I would have thought that that's quite a long way away from what the DA stands for.
I don't know the people again involved or the details, so it's difficult to say. So don't think that I'm commenting on these individuals, because I'm not. I don't know who they are. But broadly generally speaking, if I'd be very wary as a political party of who you take inside, if there isn't a track record of values that's demonstrable, that aligns with those of your party. The placement of, and it's certainly not a comment on this situation because I don't know the facts of it, the placement of Trojan horses inside political parties to destabilize them is a well-established issue in the country. It likely happened in the UDM the first time around. It certainly happened in Cope, when Cope broke out of the ANC. I have little doubt that it's the case inside the EFF. I would be surprised to learn that this had never occurred inside the ranks of the DA. So as the political balance in the country shifts, just be wary of the dirty tricks of placing people inside your opponent's parties with a brief in time to essentially detonate some sort of internal crisis and undermine the progress of that party. But as I said, that's a general comment. It's not a comment on this circumstance, which I don't know the details of well enough to comment on it intelligently.
Sure. That's an interesting thought, given that the DA's mayor of Cape Town, Jordan Hill Lewis, is really celebrating on social media that the leaders of his two opponents have moved across. But I guess if you're going to take a Trojan horse, and again, nothing to say with the individuals, I don't know them, but if you're going to put a Trojan horse in, well, then you're going to go with someone you trust, one of your leaders. Let's hope that isn't the case, and we certainly aren't casting assertions there. But as you say, it's an interesting time that we're going through. Corne Mulder yesterday was warning that the Government of National Unity has a limited time to actually get its act together. He said that it has had, is it 10 months now that it's been together, and that it's got only another 50 months to go. So it's already 1/6 of the time, and that seems to have been lost. And if the GNU does not deliver economic growth and jobs, well, the GNU is going to be something very harmful to the political parties involved. That was his thought. What do you feel about that?
No, he's right. Of course he's right. Why is the ANC so low? It's low because really after about 2007, 2008, it stopped meeting the material expectations of its supporters. Through the years of Mandela and Mbeki, the economy added about 500,000 net new jobs per year. Through the era of Mr. Ramaphosa, the number was less than 100,000. There's your problem. And as a consequence, he absolutely crashes the ANC. But the same trends and influences will attach to the GNU. And if it's unable to get up the rate of growth and therefore jobs to 200,000-400,000 a year, then you must expect that public confidence in the GNU will also deteriorate. Now, 100 days into the GNU, 58% of the public felt that it was performing well, which is a very strong number. It actually split 2-1 in favor of people who thought it was performing well. 200 days in, that figure had fallen by 10 percentage points to 48, which is still very strong. Doesn't mean 52 thought it was performing badly. 48 thought it was performing well, and 20-something thought badly, and the rest weren't sure. It's a still strong number. But you can already see the trend there. I think when the GNU started, because the fear of the alternative was so great that it would be the EFF and MK, that there was a sense that as long as it's not, well, as the DA put it, as long as it's not the end of the world.
Doomsday coalition.
The doomsday. Yeah. The doomsday. As long as it's not doomsday, we've won. And that was right and true. And the GNU was very important because doomsday coalition would have been damaging. But I think the point Corneille makes, which is right, is that once you've evaded doomsday, which has been achieved, just simply maintaining the status quo is not going to save the country, because the rate of unemployment officially sits just above 30%. You can expand that depending on which group you're talking to amongst, let's say, young black women, you can expand it to over 70%. As long as you maintain that rate of unemployment in an economy that's growing at 1%, you will always run the risk of a future populist destabilization. And hence the GNU objective having very successfully, I think, evaded the risk of the alternative coalition, now needs to restore growth. And to restore growth, there's an order of things. The first is confidence. Now, after 1994, business confidence rose in unison with consumer confidence. And the latter could rise quite strongly because interest rates had essentially been cut in half in the first decade. And household debt levels were relatively low, certainly a lot lower than they are today. So there was great untapped domestic consumer potential. Neither of those two options exist today. You can't cut rates in half from the present position. And household debt levels are very much higher. So you can't use the domestic consumer economy as your trigger for growth. You need external capital to enter. And then external capital needs to enter to the degree that the rate of fixed investment to GDP increases from the current 15% to 25%. So we're almost doubling the rate of fixed investment. And that means you need to lift investor confidence levels far above what they are at the moment. These things are all measurable. We measure them all the time. The investor confidence is at a rate far below what it was between, let's say, 2000 and 2007 and 2008. And that needs to be the single objective of the GNU. And if it meets that objective and it raises the rate of fixed investment from the current 15% towards 20 and then towards 25, let's say it does that over a period of 5 or 6 years, then it will gradually lift the rate of economic growth to 2% and 3%, 4%. And South Africa creates about 100,000 net new jobs per point of GDP growth per year. And it's an interesting rule of thumb that holds true. It shouldn't hold true. There's no fundamental reason why it should, but it does. So if you want to go back to that era we mentioned earlier where the country's creating 500,000 net new jobs per year, you've got to raise the rate of economic growth to 4 or 5%. That means fixed investment levels of 23, 24, 25, 26% of GDP. If that is if that is what the GNU achieves, South Africa will be very, very successful. If it's not what the GNU achieves, one option is that the status quo drags on into the long term. That it could just be that. We'll be an unequal society. The wealthy elites will live in enclaves and will continue into perpetuity. But you'll always live with this risk that that might be naive. And at some point there'll be a trigger which exploits the vast level of economic exclusion in that unemployment figure to bring about some kind of populist uprising, and South Africa suffers a serious decline and destabilization as a consequence.
You know, I can just hear people saying, yeah, France, you're like a stuck record. You're telling the same story over and over again. But it's really that basic and that simple. It is, you need to get the investment to get the people to employ. And if you don't have people who are going to employ, then you are not going to have you're going to continue to run the risk. But it was interesting the point that you made there about 500,000 jobs. If we take our population of 60 million people, and if we take just 1% population growth that is coming into the market, that's 600,000 jobs that you should be creating every year. And I think the population growth is quite a bit higher than 1%. So there's another little issue to kind of put into our pipes and smoke it. But where are we going to, Franz?
Mm-hmm. Well, it's the nicest thing someone said to us all year, that we're terribly boring. We just say the same thing year in and year out. because that's all there is to say. There is nothing else to say. And, you know, it's not hard. We're not proposing that our finance ministry staff win Nobel Prizes. This is what every emerging market does. They all grow at 4 or 5%. And they all have, you know, what's the global rate of unemployment? 5%. And whether you're an advanced economy, developing economy, emerging economy, it's all 5%. In much of the world, unemployment isn't a thing because it doesn't exist, because it's impossible. So obviously your economy grows at a suitable rate. So we're not suggesting anything. You know, don't think this is far-fetched or ambitious, or by the relative standard, it's ambitious. This is dead simple stuff. You create an environment in which people are willing to commit capital. We have such amazing skills base in the country. Entrepreneurial potential. The infrastructure is a bit creaky, but it's very good relative to a lot of the region, and a lot of. I mean, as you know, Trump says something interesting about American airports. He says it's like arriving in a third world country, and in many respects, it is. I mean, flying in from from the U.S. back into South Africa, landing at ORT, that always strikes me that he's correct. We're ahead of many just on an airport. So don't just breeze over what we've said here, that, oh, you guys say the same thing every time and it's a far-fetched, it'll never be achieved. It is elementary and very easy to do. We could easily do
it. It is elementary. It is a message that is not landing, though, with the ANC. Is this because they're just panicking? They don't know. You know, when you're in high stress mode, you can't think. And given what happened in that by election, you would have hoped that and other by elections as well, and the polls that the SRF and the IRR have done, you'd have hoped that somebody's in the ANC would have now woken up and said, "Damn it, we got to do something about this." But are they just in such a denial state or in stress state that they can't think straight?
Now we're talking about an interesting thing. I find one-on-one, the conversations are pretty easy on this stuff. And you, with serious people. And even take something like the U.S. I haven't yet come across a serious ANC person who does not wish to see the relationship with the U.S. set right. And properly so. So, I've seldom of late come across anyone who would challenge a single point of what we've said. And more likely than not, they'd say it's worse than you realize for us. We're in more trouble than you guys think. So, and the thesis is accepted that confidence to fixed investment to growth to jobs is what our entire survival hinges on. So I think the problems lie in some other interesting areas. One is the management structure of the ANC. I wonder if it's not doomed because of that. You know, the board, as it were, if you think of it as a corporation, the board is essentially the National Executive Committee. That's got 80 ordinary members and 20 hangers-on. It's 100 people. And these are 100 people who wish each other ill and have very diverse interests. Number one. Now, even if they were united in their vision, getting a board of 100 people to agree on what to do is impossible. So now we've got 100 people who disagree on what to do. The next problem that you have is that the leadership, the chairman of the board, wishes to proceed on the basis of consensus. So once we've agreed what to do, then we will move ahead. And if we can't agree, we'll split the difference. So we've proposed to increase the rate of VAT to 2%. Disastrous for politically suicide. And instead of intervening appropriately in the first hour after this proposal was made, wherever it was first made, it's allowed to develop. And then at the end, the proposal is, well, you know, if we maybe we can cut the increase in half and settle it that way. So now you're getting less, you wouldn't have got much revenue out of it to begin with, but, you know, on paper getting less revenue, but the same political damage. So I wonder if not, if the ANC isn't structurally doomed. It cannot save itself, even though its better people want to be saved and wish to save themselves and understand what needs to happen. When you go back into the structure, you can't take a decision. And when the I spoke to you earlier about, as I mentioned earlier, the Trojan horses that sabotage political parties from within. Don't be naive about what goes on. Inside the NEC of the ANC, there's such diverse interests with such long tentacles that extend all around the world that the ability to move ahead is not there. Then the only way, how do you break the deadlock? You need an absolutely ruthless leader who just overrides this stuff. But you don't have that. You've got a consensus seeker. Now, I don't think you could have many top CEOs on your show who would tell you the way we built our businesses, the really successful guys, was we sought broad consensus on what to do, and then we moved ahead. You know, Musk didn't seek consensus, moved ahead. Trump didn't seek consensus, moved ahead. So I think, Alec, the problem isn't an understanding of the problem, and I don't think it's denial about how serious it is in private. I think it's structural, perhaps. And if that's right, that's almost, from an ANC perspective, it's almost worse. Because if it was a misunderstanding, you could correct the misunderstanding with a good argument and time. And it's not quite that easy, but yeah. But if we've diagnosed it as a structural problem, then the ANC has an even bigger problem, because it might mean that even if it wishes to change, it cannot do so.
So here's something from left field. Mashatile is regarded as a crook, as a bad person. He's certainly been painted as that. But if he were to succeed Ramaphosa, does he have that ruthless streak? Does he have the ability to actually just override this consensus-seeking disaster that the ANC has visited on itself?
I don't know. But you asked the right, not talking about him, but you asked the right kind of question. There's this idea in sort of Western world, and South Africa's middle classes are essentially part of the Western world, that you need a really nice leader who, you know, sort of liberal democrat and that, and he'll find consensus and build mutual understanding and total fatal in politics. Who were the great reformers that set emerging markets right? Let's go from the end of the Second World War. There's Deng certainly is one in China. Lee Kuan Yew in Singapore, Park in Korea. I'd say Kagame in Africa is a good example.
Phuket in Vietnam. Phuket in Vietnam. Who was a Viet Cong general. So
Because it takes such brutality to do reform that if you, and I don't know about Mr. Mashatile much at all, but if I had to, let's say I was had to advise him, who should the ANC's next leader be? I'd say, well, in the interview panel, you want to check these boxes. On the priority has to be survival. Very bright and absolutely cold-blooded ruthlessness to get it right. And if you have a candidate that ticks those boxes, who'd snort with derision at the idea of consensus-seeking with anyone, then maybe they've got a chance. But short of that, the structure, they're going to make it difficult for them to make the decisions they need. What can, of course, then happen is ANC support continues to decline, and support for the others continues to lift. And maybe you then get a dynamic in a future GNU where it moves modestly towards some degree of reform, and we get the growth rate up to 2 to 3%. But you always at this sort of point in the discussion, I think of something Moletsi Mbeki said about the GNU, which is that its tragedy was that the ANC and the DA had quite a lot in common on policy, which meant that there was little prospect for the extent of the ruthless reforms that are needed to raise the growth rate to 4 or 5%.
Franz, just to close off with another point that Cornet made yesterday was the court case on the VAT increase between the DA and the ANC has grown the trust deficit between the two parties. You know, let's call it what it is. It's a coalition that's running South Africa at the moment. And as a consequence of that, he was worried that that trust deficit is so great that it will be very difficult to overcome it. If you were advising both sides, how would you address that issue?
I don't know. I mean, Cornet is there in the government. I'm not. So, I would say, let me come at it from this angle, that the ANC put itself in an absolutely impossible position on VAT because its own supporters were split very firmly against the idea of increasing taxes. And if we've asked people about why they vote for the ANC, obviously, and one of the reasons in the answers is because it is in power and it's powerful. You might be disillusioned with it, but, you know, in the end, all things being equal, you vote for the powerful guy and kind of hope for the best. So in last year, the support goes to 40%. That's a blow. But I think this climbing down on VAT and being rolled over by the DA is as serious for them in terms of a consequence as they lost last year. Because it says they're weak and they can be beaten. And the sort of invincibility, the sort of ANC monolith that was so powerful now seems not so powerful anymore. And I don't think they put themselves in an absurdly impossible position. If they had stood on this VAT thing, they'd just have hemorrhaged support. But in climbing down on it, They have, I think, done something quite significant in that they have made themselves look weak and they've made the DA look relatively strong. And regardless of the trust deficit, I imagine the trust deficit was there already. I mean, it was there already. I don't know if it's worse or better. But I think that's neither here nor there then in the main for me. What I've thought incredibly important is how the power balance has been altered in the minds of people. Because once you climb down once on something, you know, it can easily become a habit. And I think what the ANC might have done through its blundering is to train the DA to be strong. You know, early in the GNU, my sense of it was that the DA came across sometimes a bit like a guest in the ANC's house. You know, they'd gone into government and was all sort of new. And that, as it must be, I suppose. But now, no longer. Now the DA has employed power, real power. We talk of ruthlessness. This was ruthless and brilliant by whoever the DA strategists behind this were. And I think once you've done that once or twice, you probably quite enjoyed the sensation, and you're going to do it again. And your ANC colleagues know this. And therefore, this, that climb down from a political perspective was as significant an event and changes the balance in the country to the same extent or an equivalent extent to the 40% loss that the ANC suffered last year. And I don't think that's a bad thing. I didn't watch Corneille's comments, and I have very high regard for him, so I'm not quibbling with his assessment of it. But I think trust is less important than the ability to make your partner in government understand that you have the ability to be ruthless. And that therefore, when we talk, we better come to terms quickly. Because if not, we are prepared to force consequences. And my little impression of one of the reasons why the ANC folded was they looked at the alternative GNU option. So without the DA, with the DA, the National Assembly's got 287 seats. Without it, it's got without the DA, the GNU is 200. If the Freedom Front left, it would have 194. Mashaba comes in, 200, and one or two others, you get about a 202 alternative GNU. But at 202, the ANC understood that you've now got four or five parties with the ability to collapse the government. So you've got four or five guns to your head. And some of those parties are very wild, a bit unstable. And have you really improved your position now? Whereas at 287, the government only collapses with the agreement of the DA, which is much more serious and has vast numbers of supporters to take into consideration. And so the early kind of bravado of kick out the DA, they don't matter, we won't be dictated to, I think the understanding became that if we trade from 287 to 202, we're putting ourselves in a horrible position, much more dangerous position than we were. And if we boot the DA out, more than that, there's the prospect of a vote of no confidence in Mr. Ramaphosa. Here's an interesting insight, but I just want to, this is worth saying. We tested vote of no confidence opinion. And if the DA said we're calling a vote of no confidence in Mr. Ramaphosa because of the slow pace of reform, kick him out of the government, end his political career, I think that vote could go through the National Assembly, could succeed. ANC supporters, a quarter of them would support that vote and three quarters of them would oppose it. ANC supporters. But amongst black opinion, it splits 50-50. And you know, if you've polled South Africa over years, black opinion and ANC opinion were always so close to each other that you really didn't have to look at the one or the other. You didn't have to look at both. You could look at one or the other and you kind of knew where people were. It's absolutely remarkable that a position has now been reached where ANC opinion on something like booting the president is fundamentally at odds with black opinion on whether the president should be booted. And that goes to your question on the GNU, the resetting of the balance of power and the ability of the DA to demonstrate that it can be ruthless, I think is the most significant political development we've seen in a very long time. And I think, given that my sense of it is that You make progress through this ruthless brutality and not through this kumbayas, you know, holding hands and hoping for the Rainbow Nation. I think it's actually very important from the perspective of raising the odds of a future unity government finding it will take time, a lot of time, years. We might have to wait for the second iteration of the GNU after 2029. But where the core partners understand that the other has the capacity for ruthlessness, the prospects for moving towards reform are much better than where we were 300 days ago when the GNU started.
There's so much in what you've shared with us today, Frans. Thank you. Our role at BizNews is really just to provide the information that our audience, who we regard as we never underestimate their intelligence, although sometimes it is possible that their knowledge is not at the same level that it could be at. This is going to provide a lot more knowledge, a lot of thinking to be done over this. But it also reminds me of what Neil de Beer said in the Sunday show on the weekend, when he referred to Suki Cyril, as he calls him, as the cupcake president. Well, clearly that's on the opposite side of the spectrum to what South Africa needs to create jobs to fulfill its destiny of being a great nation, not just of Africa, but of the world. Who knows? Maybe what we witnessed in the past month is going to be a landmark in that progress. Dr. Frans Cronje is the chairman of the Social Research Foundation. I'm Alec Hogg from biznews.com.